I'm sorry. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Check 1212. Thanks. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A group here in Michigan has spent the past year asking Michiganders, what do you want in public education? On today's show, what they found. And we tag along with Hostile Detroit on a behind-the-scenes look at Detroit's hidden art destinations. But first, the subject of gun control is very much on America's national front burner and on the front burner here in Michigan. A set of bills was introduced in the state Senate. One of those bills, SB 59, was vetoed by Governor Snyder late last year during lame duck. But two more are making their way right now through the Senate. Let's get up to speed on all of this as we're joined by Michigan Public Radio State Capitol reporter Jake Neer. Jake, let's start with Senate Bill 59, the one vetoed by the governor. Refresh our memories. What was the purpose of that bill?
Well, it would have allowed people with a certain amount of training and a special permit to carry concealed weapons into places like schools, daycare centers, churches, and sporting events. These are places typically recognized as gun-free zones. It's important to mention that the bill would have also banned gun owners from carrying openly in those areas. But it's a pretty clear example of the debate ramping up between groups that say these kinds of measures would make places and like schools safer, and those that say they would make them more dangerous places. And of course, supporters of this bill felt it would make them safer. As to Governor Snyder's veto, it's important to remember that this bill was passed literally just hours before the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and it's very possible that that played a key role in his decision to veto it just a few days later. But many people close to the issues, close to this issue, say it had more to do with Snyder's insistence that places like schools and churches should be able to opt out of allowing guns on the premises. And that was a deal breaker for lawmakers that supported the bill. They said it might conflict with other state laws, which could have led to legal action against it. It's going to be interesting to see if sponsors reintroduce the bill this year, as they said they would.
Now, Senate Bill 63, one of the pair making their way through the Senate. What would it do, Jake?
Well, this bill was introduced by State Senator Phil Pavlo of St. Clair Township, and the bill would it would basically say that any guns, accessories, or ammunition made entirely in Michigan, sold in Michigan, and that stay within the state's borders cannot be subject to federal regulations. It's basically an attempt to bypass the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution that gives the federal government the ability to regulate interstate commerce. So that's effectively what it would do.
And I'm just kind of interested, did the senator not pay attention in government class when they taught us that federal law trumps state law and it's actually the Supreme Court of the United States who decides whether our constitutional rights are being trampled on?
Well, you know, that is something that the federal government has said in the past, specifically to similar gun laws passed or brought up in states that, like you said, federal gun laws trump state laws. So basically what that means is that a legal battle is pretty much guaranteed if this bill becomes law in the state.
Do you think there is an honest expectation that this bill would pass and become law by those who are trying to get it through?
It's really difficult to tell, and one of the things is that's interesting to look at is when it comes to lawmakers' track record recently, at least with getting some of the more controversial gun-related measures passed and then of course signed into law, it really hasn't worked out so well for them lately. It seems like there's something that comes up, some sort of stumbling block, almost every time one of the more controversial gun bills has come up in the last several weeks.
What do you mean?
Well, for example, earlier in the year, there was also a bill that would it had to do with state background checks, and it basically would have done away with state background checks altogether. And that basically that language was completely dropped. And that bill became, I don't want to say innocuous, but, compared to what it would have done when it was proposed, it was fairly innocuous.
Now we have Senate Bill 49. Talk to us about that one, Jake.
Under this bill, the public would no longer have access to information from things like pistol license applications or a state database that tracks the histories of pistols. It's almost sort of like a Carfax for pistols, almost. And basically, this bill would say that You can no longer get this information through Freedom of Information Act requests.
And what is the intent of doing that? What do the backers want to accomplish?
Well, it's a reaction to a publication in a New York State newspaper that published the names and addresses of gun owners in their area, which basically outraged pro-gun groups and gun owners the gun owners that were mentioned themselves. So, I believe that there are other states too that have reacted to this, including New York, which actually in their big gun control measure that was just passed, that legislation also had a similar measure in it to this.
In fact, that newspaper has taken down. Not that it isn't living out there, but they have removed that map. And you're right, that was a huge national story. Yet it's coming at a time when much of the conversation about gun control or gun safety has to do with the source, like who's buying them and how are the people who are legally buying them, how does a gun then get into the hands of someone who shouldn't have one?
Well, that's interesting because, some of the biggest backlash about this bill has come from reporters and journalism groups that have said legislation like this would be an overreaction, basically, and could really hinder their ability to report on things like gun crimes.
I'm sure you see this, Jake Neer, as you're covering the state capitol and the folks on either side. It's so difficult to have conversations about what should or should not happen with guns because there really does not seem to be much of any middle ground. It's so polarizing.
Well, this has historically been a very heated debate. And of course, since the tragedy in Connecticut, it's something that it seems like this debate has progressively gotten more intense. And now we're seeing a lot of reactions in state legislatures. And of course, on the federal level with the Obama administration and their proposed gun control legislation. It is something that's going to be interesting to see how it's handled here in Lansing over the next several months, if it goes that long with some of these bills, to see what the discourse is going to be like and to see if state lawmakers can compromise with some of the issues that Governor Snyder has brought up about some of these bills in the past. It's yet to be seen what's going to happen from here on out.
Michigan Public Radio State Capitol reporter Jake Neer, thanks so much for talking with us today, Jake.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. Glad to be on your show.
At long last, the puck drops on the ice at Joe Louis Arena tonight as the Red Wings finally play their home opener hosting the Dallas Stars. Now, this moment couldn't come soon enough, especially for Wings fans and for downtown Detroit businesses. Those local businesses really took a hit during the nearly four-month-long NHL lockout. Michael O'Callaghan is the VP and COO of the Detroit Metro Convention and Visitors Bureau. He's joining us now. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Cynthia.
So give us a sense, how much does Red Wings hockey mean to these downtown restaurants and bars and other businesses?
Well, it means a great deal to them. We've analyzed this stuff over time and, get a sense for, based on the attendance at the games, number of people coming into the city. And at the end of the day, the big picture is that every Red Wing game that takes place brings about $1.8 million of revenue into the city of Detroit. And, that transcends into dollars that end up going out to cab drivers and parking lot attendants and restaurant employees, et cetera, et cetera. So the loss of the Red Wings in the last half of last year, quarter of last year, meant there were a lot of people who expected that those paychecks were coming and they didn't come in. So this is really, really big on an economic level, but certainly on a personal level for people.
As you say that, it makes me stop and think, because we do try to get to a lot of Wings games. And so when we get down there and we pay for parking, and then after maybe we go over to Lafayette mm-hmm. Coney for our hot dog fix, all of that money, everybody doing that, that's so true. You think about that ripple effect and spreading outward. Have any businesses gone under, Michael, as a result of the lockout that you're aware of?
No, I don't think so. Fortunately, there's been a nice resurgence of business into downtown Detroit. And those businesses in Greektown, et cetera, have certainly managed to hold on. And you have to remember that they've been through this once before. So, you know, I'm sure yes. they were prepared for it.
So counting tonight's home opener, the Wings will be playing 24 home games in this mini season. So what will that mean in terms of dollars and cents for downtown businesses?
Well, so it's going to mean about $40 million in revenue just off of the regular season, $40 million in direct spend into the city of Detroit. And then once we get through the regular season, we have to believe the Red Wings will get into the playoffs. And then the stakes get even bigger because then you start bringing in an audience from outside of metropolitan Detroit.
Media.
You bring media in, et cetera. You've got hotel guest room stays and multiple night stays, et cetera. So those dollars get even bigger.
So let's just hope the Wings who show up tonight are the ones who beat Columbus last night and not the Wings who got beaten so badly and shut out in St. Louis last Saturday. I'm sure we are all hoping for playoff action.
That's right. Let's assume that we will not see the Wings who played in St. Louis the other night again.
Michael O'Callaghan of the Detroit Metro Convention and Visitors Bureau, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, we will tag along with Hostile Detroit on a behind-the-scenes look at Detroit's hidden art destinations. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside on this very, very cold Tuesday. I'm Cynthia Canty. Welcome back. We turn now to the subject of Michigan's schools. Virtually everyone agrees that having good schools is crucial to Michigan becoming a prosperous, thriving state. And virtually everyone agrees much needs to be done to shore up the state of education in Michigan. On any given day in Lansing, policymakers and legislators are talking about education reform, what to do, when to do it, how to pay for it. But the nonpartisan nonprofit Center for Michigan noted that amidst all the speeches, draft legislation, and testimony in Lansing, one voice is virtually absent, that of you, the people of Michigan. So they set about a process of listening to voices all around our state. They got more than 7,500 people to take part in more than 250 statewide community conversations, plus two large online samples. And the result is a major report unveiled today. It's called The Public's Agenda for Public Education. Joining us, John Bebo, President and CEO of the Center for Michigan, and Amber Toth. She's the Outreach Director for the Center. John, I want to start with you right at the beginning. How did the people of Michigan grade our schools?
They're concerned. More than half of Michigan residents who took part in this process gave a grade of C or lower to the statewide education system. That, to us, signals that the attention to education in Lansing, the attention to it is certainly on the mark because people are concerned. And I think more important than the general grades, I think you have to look at the toughest critics of the system today.
Yes.
Who happen to be low-income and minority residents. That is something we saw consistently across our community meetings. And I think that says that those who most need that economic ladder that a great education provides are feeling least well-served by today's system. So I think the sense of urgency here is pretty clear.
Before we get into what ideas the public had for fixing the schools, what were the major sources of dissatisfaction, the major concerns that the public has? If we wanted to talk about Michigan as one voice.
You know, it's all over the map. A couple of the anecdotes that stuck out to me as we went through the reams of data from this and put together the report. We had a student in a community conversation say, my government textbook says Ronald Reagan was the last president. That's one of the anecdotes that really sticks out to me. We had other people at the opposite end of the spectrum concerned about how we spend money, whether we're spending it the right way, whether we've fully fixed pension and health care costs and efficiencies in education. There are so many concerns expressed in the report, this report is by no means a lambasting of the education business or the education service industry, but people are concerned, and people feel that in this economy, as tough as it is, and this global competitiveness that we're in, it's not your grandma and grandpa's education system anymore, and people are eager to see public attention on it.
What kinds of differences did you hear in these public conversations? And I know you also did online polling to gather data as well. I'm curious, Amber Toth, what kind of differences did you hear from the teachers, the ones who are delivering the service, versus the customers, the parents and the students? Were they on the same page with concerns, or did you hear divergence?
There really wasn't, and I don't know whether I was surprised by that or not, but it was striking how close the customers of the education system were to those who are providing education to our students across the state. On issues of what sometimes I'm calling our teacher or educator treatment issues in this report, so things like improved teacher preparation as well as support for our educators and accountability for our educators, the customers as well as educators themselves were very close in their belief that we need to improve all of those areas. So it was encouraging to see how many Michigan residents are on the same page, regardless of what side of the kind of education debate they might be on, that those who are providing the education as well as those who are receiving it are really close together on those issues.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're talking today with John Bebo, who's president and CEO of the Center for Michigan, the nonpartisan nonprofit group, and Amber Toth, who is the outreach director for the Center for Michigan, about today's report being unveiled, The Public's Agenda for Public Education, How Michigan Citizens Want to Improve Student Learning, the result of over 7,500 people taking part in more than 250 stateside community conversations, plus a couple of very large sample polls, really listening to the voice of the people. So with that said, after a year's worth of listening to the people, you found a four-part agenda that the citizens, the public would lay out to improve our schools. John, what would be the four cornerstones of that?
I'm going to bury the lead just a little bit,
sure,
Cynthia,
enough,
because I wanted to address a couple things that you and Amber just talked about. I think in general there was a lot of similarity, but there were a couple of points where we did notice some difference. Educators are more protective of today's system than other people are. For example, people who identified themselves as educators thought the system provides a pretty good return on investment at much higher levels than other people did. But at the same time, we saw instances where educators were as tough on the system or tougher than other members of the public. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
It's the issue of teacher preparation. educators, more than just about any other demographic group, said we have to raise the bar for the profession. And I thought that was pretty striking.
Okay.
Now, to the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
We did find compelling two-thirds public support for four key priorities here.
Which is important in order to build a sense of consensus and people getting behind this. So where do you begin? What was the most important?
I'll begin with one that's becoming a front burner topic in Lansing, and it has to do with early childhood.
We heard it in the State of the State.
We did hear it in the State of the State. We've heard it from the Speaker of the Michigan House, and we've heard it from leaders in the Senate, like Senator Roger Kahn, who chairs the Budget Committee in the Senate. There's growing momentum for this, and the public recognizes or senses a need for more attention to the idea that school doesn't begin the first day a child walks into the kindergarten classroom. It begins much earlier, and there is a thirst out there in the public for more attention to early childhood, which is becoming a front burner issue and will continue to be as the budget unveils this year. In essence, nobody is going to get voted out of office in Lansing for supporting early childhood. We see compelling two-thirds public support for that across the state.
Okay. Now, teacher prep, you said, was an important
Absolutely.
Thing.
There is another issue. And in contrast to early childhood, where we see a lot of policy development, mm-hmm. the second issue we heard about was teacher preparation, raising the bar to become a teacher in this state. We heard this across the table. As I just said, educators are some of the strongest proponents of this themselves. Now, you don't often hear about a profession where people say, you know what, it ought to be tougher to get into this profession than it is. Teachers themselves are saying that to us.
So you're talking about who gets into education programs in college, what the coursework is, and how they're trained.
What we heard from the customers of education mm-hmm. as well as the educators themselves.
The practitioners.
The practitioners is raising the bar in college. Tougher to get a teaching certificate, tougher to get certified, more mastery of content, subject material that you're going to go teach is what people want. People are beginning to become taken with some other models around the world, such as Finland, where teachers are treated by society with a considerably higher level of respect. They have higher pay, and they are expected to produce higher results. And people are beginning to catch on to some of these systems around the world and wonder why we don't do some of those things here. That's going to be a tough one to implement. It's not on anybody's front burner in Lansing. You have many different schools of education at our colleges and universities. There is no one standard for what you go through in those programs. There are recommendations. It's talked about in the Michigan Department of Education, but it's a tough one to ride herd on, and we think it's going to take a while to bring this public desire to full fruition.
Then when it comes to once they are in the schools and they are educators, there's a desire for more support for
Well,
educators.
That's the grand bargain here.
Yeah.
We heard people that they're tough on the system. They don't grade the statewide system very highly. They want better prepared teachers coming into the schools when they start. At the same time, there's a sense that educators have been beaten up. That there's need for more support, meaning better ongoing training. There's an idea that has been expressed by both the president of the state board and the governor, a Democrat and a Republican alike, that we develop a system of true master teachers and that we reward them for reaching that level. There are several different models of doing so. One of them is national board certification. If you look at states like North Carolina, they have thousands of these nationally board certified teachers. Michigan, we have a few hundred. It's not a huge expense to have people go through that program. But there is a sense that that's one of the ways we can be more supportive. Another way, and the fourth one we'll talk about is accountability here in a minute. But there is one idea that bridges both the idea of being more supportive and the idea of holding educators more accountable. It has to do with evaluating educators, and we think this is a crucial moment for some public input on that topic. There is a committee of experts that's been at work on the idea of how to evaluate teachers.
And then the fourth part is accountability, so it sounds like parents in particular probably are looking, and we've all been through it as parents. People know within a school who's good, who you hope your kid doesn't get because they're not so effective. And so parents want to see the poor performers removed.
They do. I wouldn't say just parents.
Yeah.
Educators also. Mm. Students also. We heard accountability as a buzzword across the state, across these demographic groups. And again, some of this was happening as some new accountability measures were taking place. So I think if you're a policymaker who passed tenure reform in Lansing, I think you've got some public support here for some of those kinds of accountability measures that have been put into place in the last couple of years.
Amber Toth, as you talked all over Michigan and held these conversations, you came away with some interesting insights with respect to comparing what Lansing thinks is important in terms of school reform versus what the public thinks of ideas. So what did you find that citizens felt were lower priorities but seemed to be on kind of more the front burner in Lansing?
Sure. So we asked Michigan residents in these conversations about eight different topics, specific topics that either were research-driven, you know, research said these things might help students become more successful, or things that had been policy priorities here in the state of Michigan. And two of those eight, increasing school choice and expanding online learning, well, they had some support from many in our conversations. They just weren't the highest priority for our participants in these conversations. There was some skepticism around whether specifically online learning, if it were to be completely online learning, there was some skepticism that that's a good approach. The idea of totally getting rid of brick and mortar schools was something that Michigan residents had some skepticism about. Increasing school choice for some seemed to be very important. For others, they just said, this isn't my highest priority. There wasn't a huge sense that either of these were the worst idea in the world. They just weren't as high of a priority as some of the other items that we've talked about that really got a lot of support from residents.
And John Bebo, correct me if I'm wrong, but that whole idea of expanding school choice has a lot of traction right now in Lansing.
It definitely does. It's a front burner issue, both expanding charters as well as expanding beyond whether you go to your neighborhood school or a school down the street.
And what about the idea of class size and the school year?
Yeah.
That's another. It's kind of sexy to say, hey, we need to have them going all year round. What a difference that'll make.
Again, much like choice, it's just not an issue that rose to the very top consistently in all the ways that we measure public opinion. The issue of school class sizes is probably the toughest issue of all that we've dealt with in this report.
How so?
We heard a lot of anecdotal concern about this. The problem with the class size debate is the solution is extremely expensive. Of everything in this report, if you wanted to lower the class size by several students, you're talking major, major financial commitment. And the research data on whether class size matters or not is also pretty mixed.
It seems to matter.
It seems to matter at the early grades the most. But once you get past grade school, there isn't a lot of difference in student achievement based on high class size or low class size.
Now, this, as you're unveiling this report, the public's agenda for public education put together by the Center for Michigan, and you even have on your logo, engage, inform, and achieve. So the question now is, what will you do with this information? How will you bring this voice of the people into the conversations under that big white dome in Lansing?
Absolutely. So on January 29th, a week from today, we will be hosting an event at the Lansing Center. It's completely sold out, and we essentially are going to talk about what we found in this report and how citizens can become involved in the kind of policy agenda and perspectives that were laid out in the report. We have a very robust lineup of speakers for that event, and we're extremely excited to have We're expecting about 400 people at that event to talk about the findings of this report and what it means for the future of education in Michigan.
So you're starting with that.
We're actually launching today on our website citizen task forces that you can sign up to work more in depth on some of the issues the report raises. We want to be able to bring citizens before their legislators and interact with their policymakers and also interact at their local school district level if they want to do that. So our desire is to continue to give people ways to engage on these topics.
John Bebo and Amber Toth of the Center for Michigan. Again, their site is thecenterformichigan.net. We've put a link up on our website at michiganradio.org, and we've been talking about their new major report just revealed today, The Public's Agenda for Public Education. John and Amber, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And here at Stateside, we always love to continue the conversation with you. What do you think about the state of education in Michigan? What's working and what isn't? Let us know. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Just go there and click on the Stateside link. And we're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Wanted to let you know Michigan Radio's Jen White will be hosting our next Issues in Ale event. It's in Lansing, and we'll discuss the value of early childhood education in Michigan. You are invited to join the conversation. It's a week from this Thursday, January 31st, at Connections Comedy Club in Lansing. Admission is free. You can find out more information online at michiganradio.org. Still to come, on this, the 40th anniversary of the landmark Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, we look at women's reproductive rights in Michigan. This is Stateside. We'll be right back. Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. Today is the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. That landmark Supreme Court decision made access to abortion services a federal constitutional right rather than a matter of state-by-state policy. Here in Michigan, abortion played a role in that flood of bills passed in the waning days of 2012 by the lame duck legislature and signed into law by Governor Snyder. The so-called abortion clinic law orders doctors to screen patients to make sure they haven't been coerced into having an abortion. It mandates new licensing and insurance requirements for clinics that perform more than 120 abortions a year. This new law has been the focus of heated protests since it was first introduced back in June, and it continues to polarize public opinion. The Michigan Catholic Conference and Right to Life are among those praising the law, saying it brings about, quote, long overdue reform and regulation of the abortion industry. And those who are blasting the law, including Senate Democratic leader Gretchen Whitmer, say it only succeeds in, and here's her quote, reducing or eliminating women's access to cancer screenings and other critically important care. Critics say this law makes Michigan one of the most repressive states in the nation for women's health. Well, let's get a physician's view of all of this. Joining us is Dr. Lisa Hope Harris. She is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Michigan. Dr. Harris, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, stepping away from all the emotions swirling around this law, objectively, what does this new law mean first for Michigan women, in your view?
Well, I should say at the outset that the Michigan Department of Community Health, MDCH, has not yet issued regulations in response to the new law. So we don't actually know how the state regulatory agencies are going to interpret the law.
Okay.
But that said, I think it's fair to say that there are four components to the new laws, and you alluded to some of them.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that centers, health centers that provide 120 or more surgical abortions per year and advertise those services be licensed as freestanding surgical centers. The law does include waivers, so the ability for clinics to not comply with specific elements of the freestanding surgical center requirements if they are not necessary to safeguard women's health and safety. So that's the first.
Okay.
Clinics will very likely be able to comply with this regulation. That for some, that might mean renovations. For some, for all, that will mean new kinds of licensing requirements. And for many, that will mean obtaining waivers for certain components of the requirements. But I am confident that clinics will be able to comply. And that means that women are unlikely to be directly affected by that component of the new law. They may be indirectly affected, mm-hmm. though, because it will likely be expensive for clinics to make the changes required. And undoubtedly, some of those costs will be passed on to women, which is unfortunate. But healthcare centers that offer abortion and hospitals that offer abortion in the state are really committed to providing that care to women, no matter what the climate is, and they will buffer the effects of that.
What kinds of changes might a clinic have to do to meet this freestanding surgical center requirement?
Right. So there are very specific and lengthy requirements set out by the state for what it means to be a freestanding surgical outpatient center, or mm-hmm. FSOF. And they include many things that are all things really that are good patient care, but some of them assume a different kind of acuity of surgical procedure being performed there than abortion. And so they require surgical rooms to be a certain square footage and recovery rooms to be a certain square footage and other things that aren't really necessary to provide safe abortion care. Abortion care can be surgically provided very safely in a regular office setting.
Mm, I see. But that changes now with this law.
That's one of the things that changes. There are a couple of other things that change. So one, you mentioned also the anti-coercion measures.
Yes.
So the new law requires that health centers and health providers screen women for coercion to have an abortion. Many do this already. We screen people for all kinds of things because we want to help people and make sure that they're safe. But this law specifies that we screen people for someone coercing them to have an abortion.
So this would happen in the patient workup. This would be happening as you're taking the patient's history and talking to them.
Exactly. The materials, the law says that the state, that MDCH will develop the materials. So we're waiting to see what those will look like. But the interesting thing about this component of the mm-hmm. law is the Michigan Penal Code that actually defines what's legal and what's illegal was not changed. So to reflect that coercion to abort is a crime.
Oh.
So health centers and providers are going to be required to tell women that coercion to abort is a crime, but it is not actually a crime, at least not yet. Maybe in the next session, the legislature will address that. But it does put clinics in an interesting ethical position with respect to telling patients things that really are not true, at least not yet.
Because, as you say, there's no penalty for
this. There's no penalty for it.
And as you say, you haven't been, they haven't developed the material, so it hasn't come down. Might it consist of, here are some alternate options if you choose, if you feel you are being coerced? You have to offer options to abortion?
We do that already, centers that offer abortion do already. They present the options of continuing the pregnancy and parenting, continuing the pregnancy and adoption and abortion. So it's really interesting to me the assumptions about healthcare providers that offer abortion and about healthcare centers themselves. The law assumes that we don't have women's best interests in mind in offering abortion care. And really, that couldn't be further from the truth. People, doctors in general, and there's no reason to think doctors who provide abortion care are any different. They really want to ensure the health and safety of and well-being of their patients. And there's no reason to think that's different for abortion care providers than other doctors.
Now, what are the other elements? You said there was kind of four
building
blocks.
So there's two other elements. One is a ban on the use of telemedicine. to provide medication abortion. So there are two ways that abortion can be offered in the U.S. and around the world. And one is a surgical procedure, and that tends to be what people think of the most.
Sure.
And the other is via a pill or a set of pills in a regimen that was developed and sort of tinkered with over the past 10 to 15 years in the U.S. And for medication abortion, it isn't actually necessary for a physician to be physically in the room with a patient having the abortion. And there's been some excellent, well-done studies showing that telemedicine is a safe and acceptable way to accomplish abortion, meaning a patient in a remote area is in a health center that has healthcare providers there but not a physician who can do screening and general health assessment. And somewhere else in the state, a physician can interact with the patient via a computer or television screen or monitor.
All right.
And if that physician is satisfied that the patient is safe to go ahead with the abortion, they can press a button that will open a locked drawer at the remote site, and then the medication pill would be dispensed. So that actually is not happening in Michigan currently. There were conversations beginning to, because that would be a way to offer abortion care to women in remote areas of the state. So now women have lost that possibility.
That's off the table.
It's off the table.
All right.
Yeah.
And the fourth component.
So the fourth component specifies that fetal remains need to be disposed of through cremation or burial or incineration.
What is typical practice? Prior to this law, what has been the typical practice?
Typical practice really is those things. I can't speak for all centers.
Sure.
But
in your experience?
In my experience, fetal remains are always disposed of properly. I think there is a desire to not have the kind of image of fetuses being disposed of disrespectfully. I'm not aware in any of the settings in which I've worked where that's been the case, but it's certainly an effective rhetorical tool.
The bottom line for the women of Michigan, how does this law change things for them?
In my view, centers that offer abortion are going to be able to protect women from most of the effects of this law, and they will not feel it tremendously significantly. But I should add two things to that. One is that the original version of the law that was passed in the House and the companion bills that were initially introduced with it, those would have tremendously and dramatically affected women's access to abortion and very likely would have been so difficult for clinics and centers to comply with that it would have really diminished services in the state, if not eliminated them altogether.
How so? What would have been so difficult?
Oh, well, there were many more provisions. First of all, the original versions of the bill eliminated the waivers to certain surgical center licensing requirements. So all centers would have had to follow the complete list of requirements, and that alone may have closed down many centers. Health centers that offered medication abortion would have been required to also be licensed as freestanding surgical centers, even though they were dispensing medication and not offering surgery. The fetal remains requirements would have been very difficult to comply with and would have required as many as four different people or agencies to be involved in the disposal of fetal remains, including a funeral director, a crematory, a medical examiner, and even potentially local law enforcement.
Okay.
There was a ban on abortion, all abortion after 20 weeks, with no exceptions for rape or incest or fetal anomalies or women's health. The law as proposed back then would have required some doctors who offer abortion care to carry $1 million in liability insurance, which is not a requirement for doctors generally, and there would have been a prohibition on the most effective method of medication abortion, the most effective regimen, and we physicians would have been required to use the less effective FDA-approved regimen that's older.
All right. So that has been modified out.
Modified out, and there were many people who worked tirelessly over the summer and the fall to ensure that women would be less impacted by the law. And I actually do give credit to the governor and his staff for getting the right experts at the table to talk about what the law would mean and what the law would mean for services, and for eventually getting a bill on the table that was workable.
And again, going back to the fact that this is a constitutionally acceptable medical treatment, and so people have a constitutional right to be able to seek this treatment.
Yes.
Although you did use the phrase protecting women from, and there are some people who feel that this protects women for instance, the standards for the clinics. And there are criticisms saying that it's a move to put abortion clinics out of business to have this inspection and licensing as a surgical outpatient facility. Mm-hmm. Why would we not want to make sure that the clinics are all meeting safety and good practice requirements?
Well, of course we want clinics to meet safety and good practice requirements. And yes, advocates for the law have argued compellingly that these measures are necessary to protect Michigan women. And again, I'll point to that assumption built into the law that abortion providers themselves are not interested in exactly the same things. And I really do believe that it's unlikely that anyone cares more about the safety and well-being of women seeking abortion than the healthcare providers who are offering it. In addition, there are many skilled, accomplished researchers who are constantly trying to ensure that the safest and most effective regimens of abortion are being done. And there simply is not compelling medical evidence that surgical abortion needs to be done in a surgical center instead of an office to be performed safely. So, and many, many abortions, most abortions in this country are done safely in office settings. So, but there are two other reasons why I don't find the safety argument so compelling. And one is that providers who are offering fewer than 120 abortions a year are not subject to the requirements. And law and clinical evidence would say that the more you do of something, the better you are at it and the more safe you are at it and the more expert you are.
And that holds for any surgical procedure, any medical procedure.
Absolutely, any medical procedure. You want to see providers who are the most experienced. Mm-hmm. So if safety was really the issue instead of, say, stigma, then legislators would be more interested in regulating the people who do very few procedures because now I don't believe safety is an issue at all because abortion is so safe. Mm-hmm. But were there a safety issue, you would imagine the regulations should apply not to people providing the most care, but to people providing the least. And then finally, in the initial iteration of the law, doctors would have been required to use a less effective medication abortion regimen rather than the one that they use now. And to me, that tells me this was not about safety. This is not about what's best for women, but this is about targeting abortion providers for state regulation, regulations that are not required of other kinds of physicians.
And in your experience and in your opinion, not medically needed.
And absolutely not medically needed.
Dr. Lisa Hope Harrison, Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Michigan. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
When someone from out of town travels to Detroit, the usual destinations tend to be the Fox Theater for a concert, maybe Comerica Park for a Tiger game. But how do you explore the city on a deeper level without the double-decker buses and the big tour companies that so many other big cities have? Stateside's Emily Fox takes us to Hostel Detroit, where guests from around the globe get a behind-the-scenes look at the city.
Hostel Detroit opened its doors in April of 2011. So, Michel Soucis is the general manager. He's giving me a tour of the 100-year-old building. The outside is decorated with colorful painted bricks and murals of monster-looking creatures. Hostel Detroit is in Corktown, in a fairly vacant neighborhood across the expressway from the old train station.
It's been a while since someone said, oh, isn't that sad?
While places like the old Central Station with its skyline of broken windows is just one of the many worn-down buildings Detroit is known for, Soucis sees his neighborhood a little differently.
It's a very peaceful, vast, pastoral space with a lot of its sort of urban roots still showing.
But Soucis knows people wouldn't normally use words like pastoral to describe vacant land amidst abandoned buildings.
We're a really embattled city. I mean, everyone has a really solid idea of what Detroit is. Everyone knows what it is. You know, it's one thing, you know, or two things. It's poverty, it's crime.
But Soucis wants to change that image.
That's what we want to do is allow people to make their own story of the city rather than coming and maybe affirming a belief that someone handed down to them because they don't have the information or access.
So today, like many days at Hostel Detroit, Soucis crams in a handful of guests into a sedan and gives them a tour of the city. So let's meet the guests and take a tour.
My name's Chloe. I'm a student in Portland, Oregon, but I'm originally from Brooklyn. And I'm here as part of a cross-country tour I'm doing by train.
And there's Jonathan Dowell. He's an artist from Canada.
Detroit has always had like a mythical presence in my mind, and I've always imagined it a certain way, and I really wanted to come here and see on the ground what it was like, in particularly street art.
Our first stop on the trip is an outdoor street art project on the east side of Detroit.
So here we're entering the Heidelberg Project.
The Heidelberg is the work of artist Tyree Guyton. The project takes up an entire city block. Think of it like Sesame Street that's gone to the dark side. Houses are painted with huge, colorful polka dots, dozens of stuffed animals hang off another house, and a mix of what used to be junk is made into sculptures in the open yards. After a walk around the Heidelberg Project, we hop back in the car, and Susis gives another tour on the way to our next destination.
So to the left, you have Lafayette Park as we're doubling back, and then to the right, this is Eastern Market at the beginning of Eastern Market. So we're entering an area called West Village. So this is what's called Foxtown. We're downtown Detroit. So we're coming on to like what we call like our cultural center, art center. This is Orchestra Hall.
Our next stop is a hidden sculpture park next to the African Bead Museum. It was created by the museum's owner, Oleyame Dalbo.
So this is teaching rocks how to rust.
Oh, whoa.
Like the Heidelberg Project, abandoned objects are used to create art and sculptures. Here there are rows of chairs with rocks in them facing an African mask on a tree stump. The houses that surround the sculpture park are covered with mirrors and painted with a hodgepodge of colors and patterns. And it looks like the visitors I'm traveling with are really enjoying the place.
This is like really like a dream. It's really great that this exists. It's truly inspiring.
After the tour of the sculpture park, we pack back in the car and the travelers get dropped off at another destination.
I'll drop you at the actual entrance.
And as they're off to explore on their own, Susis, the general manager of Hostel Detroit, hopes they'll come back with a deeper understanding of the city than they did before. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
And that's Stateside for this Tuesday. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk tomorrow at 3:00.